Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 723, Doing the Earth Island Boogie. This program is being recorded on August 29th of the year 2010. And let me begin the broadcast, as always, by reminding you to use the SpitfireList.com website. I've got my entire life's work up there for download for free. And indeed, I think using that website, and in particular books like Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is essential at this point for those who would like to really get a sort of wrap themselves around the research in a serious way. I think if people are not using the website, the books in particular, then the degree of understanding that they're going to be able to acquire about what I'm talking about here will be distinctly limited. So please, SpitfireList.com, utilize that website. It's a vast research resource. And again, I think for those of you who only listen on the radio or listen to audio files on the internet are missing the better part of the For the Record experience. So please use that website. Now, this broadcast is going to be speculative in nature, and indeed the importance of grounding oneself in the research will be emphasized by this program. Let me talk about the title. The title is Doing the Earth Island Boogie. Obviously, that's a little bit of an original terminology invention by yours truly. The Earth Island, however, the concept from which that is derived, is not a new concept. In fact, it's a central concept for understanding geopolitics. The Earth Island is a term that was applied by British and German geopoliticians, well, more than that, really, but primarily British and German geopoliticians, to that stretch of land running from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, most of the Middle East, most of, the former Soviet Union, Russia, China, India, Pakistan, all of that is one vast contiguous landmass. And that landmass contains most of the world's, landmass, first of all. It also contains most of the world's population. It contains most of the world's mineral resources. And controlling that vast stretch of land, which was termed the Earth Island, again, that vast stretch of land running from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, incorporating most of what we call the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, Russia, China, India, Pakistan, controlling that stretch of land was seen as the key for achieving world domination. And of particular significance for our purposes in the discussion here is the fact, and indeed for particular significance for our discussions of September 11th and related matters, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, running right across the middle of the Earth Island is a vast stretch of lands populated primarily by Muslim peoples, peoples of the Muslim persuasion. It should also be noted that the Earth Island contains most of the world's petroleum and natural gas, and that the areas in which the Muslim populations reside and in which the petroleum and natural gas is to be found largely overlap. For this reason, geopolitical thinkers have long seen the Muslim population there, either as a controlled population or as allies, as a key to dominating the world, the Earth Island, rather. And indeed, if one wishes to gain control of the petroleum industry, and indeed fossil fuels are the greatest source of wealth and power in the contemporary world, that Muslim population of the Earth Island sits astride those natural resources. And so controlling that population or allying with it is, and how for a long time has been seen as a key. Various groups ranging from the British and Germans in the 18th and 19th, or in the 19th and early 20th century, on up through the British and the United States in the mid to late 20th century, have seen the Muslim peoples of the Earth Island as proxy warriors for various purposes. The Kaiser in World War I attempted to utilize the Muslim peoples in order to break up the Russian and British empires and achieve a foothold for the Germans in those traditionally British or Russian areas. Then in World War II, the Germans and the Japanese utilized the Islamists as proxy warriors. Should be noted that the Islamists have their own agenda as well. But what we're going to be looking at in this program is a series of things as seemingly disparate as the spy scandal, the alleged or apparent Russian spy scandal that broke in the United States earlier this year, and the flotilla farce in the Mediterranean, in which a Turkish-based ocean-going flotilla attempted to break the Israeli blockade in Gaza, with results that are at this point quite well known. What is significant, well, there are a lot of things significant about that, and one of the most significant aspects of it has to do not with anything to do vis-a-vis the Israelis or Palestinians or that entire dynamic, but Turkey itself and Turkey's politics, which are shifting from the secular orientation of Kemal Atatürk, instituted after the fall of the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I, to an Islamist viewpoint that is derived from the Bank al-Taqwa and Muslim Brotherhood milieu as well. And we're going to be taking a look at the implications of the flotilla incident for Turkey, for pan-Turkism, and we're going to be taking a look at a number of things that have been going on in and around the Earth Island. And again, I want to stress very strongly that this program is speculative in nature, but there are some dynamics that appear to be manifesting themselves in the Earth Island around Russia, the North Caucasus, Turkey, part of China, the parts of China inhabited by Turkic-speaking peoples like Xinjiang province. And we're going to be taking a look at these areas and some of the things going on and asking some questions about what might lie behind some of the developments that we've been seeing. And we're going to begin by taking a look at the spy scandal that broke in the United States in earlier this year. In June of this year, a Russian spy ring in the United States was exposed to the light of day, and this happened right on almost exactly the same time that President Obama and Russian President Medvedev had sat down to achieve something of a diplomatic rapprochement. And indeed, they did achieve something of a diplomatic rapprochement. There are many sources that have spoken about the Russian spy scandal. One of them, for example, Eurasia Review, an article by called Spy Scandal Casts Shadow on Obama-Medvedev-Berger Diplomacy. Just about any major news medium has stories in their archives from June of 2010 about this spy scandal. I'm not going to linger on the spy scandal or alleged spy scandal itself. Suffice it to say that the methodologies of counterintelligence are such that when one is investigating a spy ring, it takes a long time, and the ring is invariably under investigation for a long period of time before it becomes public. The surfacing of the Russian spy ring or alleged Russian spy ring at almost exactly the same time that Obama and Medvedev were huddling diplomatically is something that I find in and of itself to be very significant. In For the Record 706, one of our many conversations with John Loftus, we examined his discussion of really there being two CIAs, one Democratic that serves the interests of the United States, primarily anyway, and one Republican which serves the interests of the transnational corporations and which saw its genesis at the end of World War II when people like Alan Dulles and other interests, other individuals and other interests associated with the transnational corporations that had supported fascism, saw their post-war plans interdicted somewhat when Harry Truman won the 1948 election instead of Thomas Dewey. So the grafting of the residua of Nazi Germany and much of the rest of the Axis onto the fledgling U.S. intelligence system became something of a binary consideration, with really two CIAs, one associated with the Democratic Party and another the Republicans. One of the things that I was struck by when the Russian spy scandal broke, right at the same time that Obama was huddling with Medvedev, was the similarity in certain respects between this and the U-2 spy scandal back in 1959, almost exactly 50 years earlier. In 1959, then-President Eisenhower and then-Soviet Premier Khrushchev had been working out a diplomatic rapprochement. However, their summit conference was deep-sixed by the downing of a U.S. U-2 spy plane piloted by Gary Powers. Ostensibly shot down by a Soviet anti-aircraft missile, in fact, there is considerable evidence that the U-2 flight was deliberately sabotaged by elements in the Western intelligence apparatus that were looking to deliberately deep six the summit conference between Eisenhower and Khrushchev, and thereby deep six detente between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. There is a good substantive discussion of the U-2 scandal in the Guns of November Part 1. That can be found in the Guns of November section on the Spitfire website. By the way, those of you using the website, go to the right-hand side where it says Select Category. Click on that, and then there are a number of categories from which you can select a program. In the Guns of November Number 1, there's a long substantive discussion of the U-2 spy scandal and indications that elements within the Central Intelligence Agency deliberately sabotage the U-2 spy plane of Francis Gary Powers in order to, in turn, sabotage the summit conference between Khrushchev and Eisenhower and, in turn, yet again, sabotaging detente. The surfacing of the Russian spy scandal at this point in time, given the fact, and it has to have been a fact, that that spy ring, or alleged spy ring, if in fact there was a spy ring, was under investigation for a long time prior to its surfacing at this very, very curious time indeed. It's something that we've looked at as well, and that concerns something of a binary U.S. policy vis-a-vis Russia and also China as well. Although there are obviously elements in State Department and the Obama administration that are seeking areas of rapprochement with both Russia and China, it's also quite clear that there are other elements that are looking to basically interfere with both Russian and Chinese territorial matters, thereby exacerbating relations between the two. And I suspect that what we're looking at is the divide between what John Loftus conceptualized as the Republican and Democratic CIA, or what I conceptualize basically as an underground Reich element within the U.S. national security and political establishments, and that underground Reich element obviously is, well, that underground Reich element, in my opinion, is working to basically foster hostile relations between Russia and China on the one hand and the United States on the other, because that, in the long term, is will weaken the United States, and also at the same time, Germany itself is looking to increase trade with both Russia and China at the same time. And to the extent that the U.S. Agitating vis-a-vis Tibet or Xinjiang Cha province and the Uyghurs manages to alienate the Chinese, and to the extent that the U.S. Acting in support of elements within the North Caucasus serves to alienate Russia, well, that ultimately will benefit not only Germany, but it will benefit the underground Reich by weakening the United States. At the same time that the spy scandal was breaking, again, there was something of a diplomatic rapprochement underway between Russia and the United States. And one of the things that I found very interesting about this was that Russia and the U.S. had found common ground with regard to some of the Islamist insurgents in Chechnya. An article from the World Bulletin of June 25th of 2010, titled "Obama and Medvedev Meet Russia Pleased with U.S. Chechen Move," reads in part, "Meanwhile, the United States on Wednesday said it had listed a Chechen insurgent leader as a terrorist, a step that is likely to please the Kremlin on the eve of talks between Obama and Medvedev. The State Department said the listing, approved by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, would help to stem the flow of funds to Chechen insurgent leader Doku Umarov, who styles himself the Emir of the Caucasus Emirate," unquote. Quote, "The designation of Umarov is in direct response to the threats posed to the United States and Russia," unquote, Daniel Benjamin, the Department of State's coordinator for counterterrorism, said in a statement. "One of the most populous regions in the mainly Muslim North Caucasus, Chechnya, which declared independence after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 but was attacked by Russian forces twice since the mid-1990s. Still low-level insurgency continues in those Muslim states." one of the things I found interesting was that the rapprochement between U.S. and Russia found common ground on some of the Islamist insurgents in the North Caucasus. At the same time, there are elements associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think one can safely extrapolate the petroleum industry, the GOP, and the underground Reich that have been supportive of Islamist counterinsurgency, or an Islamist insurgency, I should say, an Islamist jihadist campaign in the North Caucasus. In For the Record program number 710, we went into that, and in December of 2009, there was a conference in Georgia that was held December of 2009, in which the Georgian government offered its support for a jihadist program in the North Caucasus. And this took place with apparent U.S. support. I think that apparent U.S. support should perhaps be qualified. The Republican/CIA and State Department that John Loftus, as John Loftus characterized them, or the underground Reich, State Department and CIA as I characterized them, might be better descriptive, more appropriately descriptive of the element that supported the jihadist conference in Georgia in December of 2009. I would point out that in early 2010, there were not only some devastating subway bombings in Moscow attributed to some of those Caucasian Islamist and jihadist elements, but also there have been bombings in the North Caucasus itself. So the jihadist conference in Georgia in 2009, receiving support from reactionary elements in the U.S., appears to have translated to an extent into ongoing terrorist activities, not only in the Caucasus, but also in Russia proper. Certainly, as I've noted in, among other broadcasts, For the Record 710, this type of activity can only alienate Russia and the United States, just as having people like Paula Dobryansky, Lev Dobryansky's daughter, a Ukrainian fascist Lev Dobryansky's daughter, heading the State Department desk on Tibet, that can only serve to alienate China. This at a time when the weakened U.S. economy badly needs to, and in fact the weakened U.S. society badly needs stability, and the last thing we need to be doing is messing with Russia and or China. I thought it was very interesting indeed to see this Russian spy scandal surface, and I wonder whether perhaps elements associated with, again, Muslim Brotherhood, Underground Reich, the petroleum faction of U.S. intelligence, the Saudi-linked faction of U.S. intelligence, are seeking to support the Caucasus jihadists, the North Caucasus jihadists, and to ultimately gain control of those portions of Russia that are rich in fossil fuels. So one of the dynamics that I think we need to look at vis-a-vis the Earth Island Boogie are the close timing between the rapprochement between the Obama State Department and Russia, vis-a-vis, among other things, the Chechnya insurgency and the jihadism in the North Caucasus, that the close the proximity in time between that and the breaking of the spy scandal in the U.S. is one of the things that I think we need to look at. The breaking of the spy scandal, that is, looks to me to be very much like a second U2 scandal. And again, taking a look at For the Record, taking a look at the Guns of November Part 1, will give people a good overview in that regard. Something else, I think, to be weighed against the background of, on the one hand, the jihadist conference in Georgia in December of 2009, and on the other hand, the burgeoning pan-Turkist movement. We spoke about that in For the Record 720 and 721. In parts of the former Soviet Union, including parts of the former Soviet Union inhabited by Muslim populations and Turkophone populations in particular, there has been a great deal of unrest. And in particular, earlier this summer, there was a very violent outcropping of social friction in Kyrgyzstan. Apparently, the Uzbek minority in Kyrgyzstan has been, well, they've been treated badly by the Kyrgyz majority, and in parts of Kyrgyzstan, the Uzbek minority have been Well, they've been making noise about the need for political reform on the part of the Kyrgyz establishment, and in turn that has been met with reaction by the Kyrgyz government. This exploded into violence this past June in Kyrgyzstan, and we're going to talk a little bit about that explosion of violence, the fact that the towns where that violence exploded are areas of Muslim Brotherhood activity, or activity by the Hizb ut-Tahrir, a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate. And we're going to speculate about one of the things, about some of what might be going on, or what may have been going on, in Kyrgyzstan earlier this year. The following is from a Yahoo.com article from June 13th of 2010. And note that all of this was going on at roughly the same time. The conference at which Medvedev and Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration were able to achieve a degree of rapprochement was going on at about this time. That's when the Russian spy scandal broke, and that's also when the violence broke out in Kyrgyzstan as well. And I'm wondering what may have been behind that. An article from Yahoo.com, 75,000 Uzbeks flee ethnic riots in Kyrgyzstan. It's co-authored by Sasha Merkushev and Yuras Kurmanow. It's an AP story from June 13th of 2010, and this describes the rioting and the areas where this has been taking place. Mobs of rioters slaughtered Uzbeks and burned their homes and businesses in Kyrgyzstan's worst ethnic violence in decades, sending more than 75,000 members of the ethnic minority fleeing the country in attacks that appeared aimed at undermining the Central Asian nation's new interim government. More than 100 people were killed in southern Kyrgyzstan, and more than 1,200 wounded in days of attacks, according to government estimates Sunday. The true toll may be much higher. The International Committee of the Red Cross said its delegates witnessed about 100 bodies being buried in just one cemetery and noted that the official toll is likely to include bodies still lying in the streets. Fires set by rioters raged across Osh, the second largest city in Kyrgyzstan, as triumphant crowds of ethnic majority Kyrgyz men took control. Police or military troops were nowhere to be seen in this city of 250,000, where food was scarce after widespread looting, and the few Uzbeks still left barricaded themselves in their neighborhoods. The rampages spread quickly to Jalalabad, another major southern city 45 miles from Osh and its neighboring villages, as mobs methodically set Uzbek houses, stores, and cafes on fire. Rioters seized an armored vehicle and automatic weapons at a local military unit and attacked police stations around the region trying to get more firearms. Some refugees were fired on as they fled to Uzbekistan. They were mostly elderly people, women, and children, with younger men staying behind to defend their property. And again, note that the areas of unrest here are Osh and Jalalabad. Again, these are areas where there are sizable Uzbek minorities, and there has been a history of prejudice against the Uzbek minorities by the Kyrgyz majority, and that's one of the things that has led to the unrest. I would also note that Islamist elements associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, specifically the Central Asian Muslim Brotherhood affiliate Hizb ut-Tahrir, has also been very active in these areas, and as is the case in many other areas around the world, Islamist elements have sought to take advantage of the very real social unrest and social injustice in this area in order to offer themselves as sort of the panacea, the all-embracing and all-just caliphate of Islamist political mythology. And again, note here that the unrest, the social friction between the Kyrgyz majority and the Uzbek minority has basically made those very areas, Osh and Jalalabad, areas of Hizb ut-Tahrir / Muslim Brotherhood agitation. And obviously one of the questions I'm asking, and I don't have an answer to this, is to what extent the unrest there may be part of this North Caucasus or Central Asian jihadist campaign. Are there elements, underground Reich elements, associated with Muslim Brotherhood, with the Saudis, with the Safari Club network, with the petroleum industry, basically looking to gain control of some of the Muslim-populated areas of the Earth Island now under Russian control in order to gain control of those fossil fuels, to get their hands on the oil and the natural gas, and also to fulfill the ancient, well, not ancient, but the centuries-long great game that has been played by European powers seeking to bottle up Russia geographically. There was a monograph for the Military Studies Command, basically the School of Advanced Military Studies at Fort Leavenworth, and Major Daniel Reuter put together a monograph about Hizbut Tahrir and Central Asia, and about the strength of the Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated Hizbut Tahrir in these very same areas of Kyrgyzstan, namely Jalalabad and Osh. Again, from May of 2006, The Long War in Central Asia, Hizb-ut Tahrir's Caliphate by Major Daniel J. Reuter. Jalalabad and Osh are considered Hizb-ut Tahrir strongholds where they have been persecuted by the Kyrgyz government since the late 1990s. Hizb-ut Tahrir has only limited support outside this region, and its membership is reportedly comprised of 90% ethnic Uzbeks, while Kyrgyz make up only 5%. These indicators suggest that ethnicity may have a role in the popularity of Hizb-ut Tahrir in Kyrgyzstan. The ethnic representation in Kyrgyzstan's local institutional framework is imbalanced, creating the conditions for discontent and possible civil rights violations. By the way, this is being written in May of 2006. Obviously, that's what exploded in June of 2010. Continuing, according to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Osh's Department of Interior is 80% ethnic Kyrgyz and 10% are ethnic Uzbek. The 23 provincial and city court judges in Osh are all Kyrgyz, while 9 of the 10 judges in Jalalabad province are Kyrgyz as well. Moreover, Uzbeks hold 11 seats in the Osh City Council compared to 19 Kyrgyz seats. The prosecutor's office in Osh follows a similar makeup. Since ethnic Uzbeks comprise 52% of Osh's population, 17% more than the Kyrgyz, one would expect to see a proportionate balance of representation in these key institutions. It is also clear that Uzbeks are aware of this imbalance as they have called for greater representation in law enforcement and judiciary jobs. Ethnic disparity in government and judiciary jobs in the region can generate an us versus them perception between ethnic Kyrgyz and ethnic Uzbeks. The issue goes deeper in terms of safeguarding civil and humanitarian rights of a minority group, especially if the Uzbeks are perceived as filling the ranks of the Hizb-ut Tahrir. The ethnic imbalance in key institutional positions is a factor for potential instability, such as the human rights violations at Andijan in March of 2005. On the other hand, Hizb-ut Tahrir ideology teaches that the Islamic State would have a caliphate of its leader who is elected by an assembly chosen by the people. So again, one of the questions I'm asking here is, to what extent is Hizb-ut Tahrir and the Muslim Brotherhood involved with regard to the unrest in Kyrgyzstan? And in turn, I'm wondering about the surfacing of the Russian spy scandal in the U.S. right at the same time that there was a rapprochement between Obama and his State Department and Russia. And in particular, they had been finding common ground with regard to jihadist elements in Chechnya. Is a Republican/underground Reich associated element of our State Department and CIA fighting back? Is that same element associated with the petroleum industry, Muslim Brotherhood, Saudi Arabia, the Safari Club? Again, I cannot say definitively, but looking at these dynamics, I think it's something that it's a question that we would do well to ask. This, however, further questions are going to have to remain until side two of this program, because this concludes side one of For the Record program number 723, Doing the Earth Island Boogie. This has been recorded on August 29th of the year 2010. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.